Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Film Literature and the New World Order podcast. I'm your host, as always, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. But not as always, we are not recording this on the third Monday of the month of July. We are actually talking to you on the second Saturday of August. That's not at all the right time. So my apologies for the delay in getting this episode out. If you are listening to this as it drops on the 8th of August, 2015. But as you know, I was out and about and away for much of last month on vacation and doing some things in Tokyo and all of that. So, well, we're back on track now, and there will be another episode of FLNWO coming out in just a couple of weeks. And so there's not a lot of time to get prepared for that one, but more on that at the end of today's episode. Let's start at the beginning, talking about, well, the homework that I assigned you from last time, the Daredevil television series. No, not the failed movie with that likely CIA operative whose name thankfully escapes my mind at the moment. Not the much maligned movie version that came out several years ago, but the television series that is just now coming out through via Netflix. And in order to talk about that, we're going to bring up our good friend, co-host of New World Next Week, colleague, and many other things besides, James Evan Pilato, New World Next Week, and MediaMonarchy.com. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, dude. Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck, that's it. That's exactly right. And yes, there is a case to be made that he has some CIA ties, which are interesting, but we'll leave that for the moment, because again, we're not talking about Ben Affleck and his maligned version of Daredevil. We are talking about the Marvel series, the television series, that I believe just started this year. Is that right?
It did, and much like how Netflix does their series, they just drop it all at once.
So right.
All of a sudden, all you know, dozen plus episodes are all there. And I basically, you know, I put you up to this. I suggested this.
You certainly did. I take no blame or credit for this.
Hey, I know you did one on Pink Cadillac a little bit. I started watching this probably like a lot of people. You see something on Netflix, you're maybe just looking to watch something, take a break, and I'm as guilty of that and maybe shouldn't be, but I saw that they had this new Daredevil series. I grew up reading comic books in junior high. I never actually read Daredevil, but I was kind of intrigued by it and also just sort of intrigued by the wave of new things that Netflix has been putting out, just as they're sort of getting into the content creation game. And they don't have a ton of things, so the things that they put out are at least worth a glance. And I think at the same time they put out Daredevil, they also put out a different original series called Bloodline. And I actually watched two or three episodes about that, kind of hoping it would be as esoteric as its title would imply. But after a few episodes in, I was like, oh, this is like family jerk stories with hidden secrets and things. So I switched and started to watch Daredevil. And I immediately, you know, it's really well made. The editing and the sound and all of that is really well done, because the Daredevil character is a blind superhero. So his, you know, daytime life is a criminal defense lawyer, Matt Murdock. By night, he fights crime. And this has been a comic for a long, long time under Marvel Comics. And again, it was one I grew up seeing back in the day. And so I started it not with any kind of big preconceived notions, because I was never a big fan of it, but I was struck at how well it was done. But I was also struck by how violent it was. And I'm not squeamish in a lot of ways. You know, I can watch a lot of stuff and grew up in the era of, you know, getting Faces of Death bootlegs and all that sort of media saturated stuff that, you know, that's why I call it media monarchy. But I think I'm surprised, because I've never really waded into all these Marvel movies that have been happening for the last several years. I think the story I often tell is in 1999, when I went to go see the new Star Wars movie, The Phantom Menace. Walked out so just, this is all ridiculous garbage, and I kind of walked away from a lot of movies in general and didn't watch any of the big sequels and the Harry Potters and the Matrixes and Lord of the Rings and a bajillion other things. I pretty much turned all that crap off. But when you make it as a bite-sized TV show, I might kind of watch it. But like I said, struck by how immediately violent it was, and watched a couple of episodes. And now I'll get into, I think, why the violence is sort of an interesting thing as we continue this conversation. But when I started to think about this, I thought, I certainly can't be the only one who thought, damn, this is pretty brutal. hop online, and an article from Reason that I actually posted to one of my own blogs, Navigating Netflix, how Netflix's new Daredevil series makes torture into a virtue. And I'll just read you just a couple of brief bits from this so we can kind of get on the page of where we are about this show. The Daredevil series on Netflix is about how one man, alone and with right in his heart, can change the city for the better using only one weapon, torture. Politically, the Daredevil series, based on the long-running Marvel comic about a blind superhero whose alter ego is a lawyer named Matt Murdock, is a casual mess, a melange of half-digested, not especially coherent, liberal and conservative talking points thrown together almost at random. The series' working-class Hispanics living in rent-controlled apartments under threat from evil developers is a basic lefty meme. The all-consuming corruption of government institutions, from politicians to police, is borrowed from libertarian or right-wing distrust of government. The Kingpin, the powerful crime boss and one of the Daredevil's archenemies, is a villain to liberals because he's super rich. He's a villain to conservatives because he's a dreamy and hypocritical help-the-poor idealist. In short, there's a reason for people of every political persuasion to be flattered or irritated as long as no one thinks about it too hard. But amidst the ideological confusion, the one consistent value is torture. To unravel the Kingpin's web of corruption, Daredevil resorts again and again to threats and violent interrogation. Now, James, I have to ask you, since I sort of put this on your plate, what did you think in watching these?
You know, you bring out such an interesting point there with the hyper-violence of the series and the fact that torture is one of the techniques that that Daredevil resorts to in his quest to, you know, help the people of Hell's Kitchen. And it's not something that I explicitly or consciously picked up on. I only made it through the first three episodes of the series, so perhaps I haven't made it far enough in to really pick up on that theme overall. But I do recall from the third episode where there is a scene where one of the henchmen, the thugs, is basically tied up and, yes, being tortured by Daredevil. And then in the end, he ends up throwing him off the roof, which I don't really know. Like yourself, I grew up reading comic books, but never Daredevil, so I don't know the old storylines of the original Daredevil comics. But from what I understand, in the comic book version, in the original comics, that person who he throws off the roof ends up getting paralyzed or something like that. Apparently in this series, he ends up going into a coma or something. Maybe there's some significance to the different ways that they deal with this. But long story short, I mean, it is very brutally violent, and it does it certainly does raise those questions about who the audience is cheering for and why they are cheering for it. And I'm not sure I have a pat answer for that. Again, I'm only three episodes in, but I think it certainly could be the trajectory that I've seen from the first three episodes certainly could be similar to something like a 24, which of course softened up the public imagination for torture in general, so that now you have those opinion polls showing that large numbers of Americans do support torture and do believe that it's an effective tactic against terrorists in the war on terror. And the thing that I specifically and explicitly noted about Daredevil is that it plays on very populist memes. And it's interesting that Reason article is talking about the ways that, you know, liberals and conservatives can both find something to love and about this and hate about the villain and all of that, because it is, certainly does have those sort of populist tendencies. And I think one of the most dangerous that this Daredevil series starts to unleash is the vigilante idea, which is the idea, you know, ultimately, we all have that feeling, oh, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket and the police can't keep things in line. We, you know, what we need is some hero to come along and save the day. And of course, he's going to have to kick butt and take no prisoners and torture or do whatever he has to do, because that's the only way we can imagine justice working in the world. And I think when you start to play on that idea and play on people's psychological desire for that type of law and order, quote unquote, I think it can unleash some pretty potentially dark forces. And that's, you know, that's one of the propagandistic aspects of this that I'm a little bit concerned about.
Well, and I think you almost bring up a point that I think I was kind of hinting at on our most recent Neural Next Week, as we see a bunch of memes kind of swirling around. The one I'm specifically kind of talking about is the Cecil the Lion. How, you know, the one event, if given enough attention, whips a bunch of people into a frenzy to where they're calling for a guy's death. And there's never, you know, no jury, no trial, no nothing. You're basically perceived to be a bad guy, and the digital pitchforks are going to come to you, and they're going to turn into real pitchforks in a lot of ways. But that's probably some other whole kind of conversation. But on the Reason article, the comment section is pretty big and, of course, annoying, like a lot of comment fields. But one of them specifically says Jack Bauer begets Daredevil as Chris Kyle begets ... referring, of course, to our hero Sniper. But one of the other comments also notes superhero stories are always state propaganda. So I think you can look at it that way. And I've got a few links, actually, that we can include in the show notes I'll throw to you. One that maybe has a better take in some ways, or at least a more informed take about the character we're talking about of Daredevil. There's an article on comicbook.com called Daredevil Torture and the Importance of Context. And I won't really get into all of that, but it has a lot more screen grabs of frames from the Daredevil comic from the past that kind of shows some of these issues in some of these ways where he actually even says, you know, I'm not God, I'm not the law, and I'm not a murderer. Where even then the police commissioner is saying, well, if you don't kill this guy, he's just going to come back and kill, and then it'll be your fault. So it does leave it a little more open-ended. So I think a take from comic book people is probably in order here, James. But I think the larger thing that this really showed me, and it was something that I've known about because it sort of exists in the big pop culture stew, and that's Marvel Comics got bought by Disney. Do you know this whole
story? Not really, no, no.
So back in 2009, actually, it officially happened, and even the New York Times article at the time, Disney swoops into action buying Marvel for $4 billion. Marvel, through those previous years, had pretty much stumbled, and I think were actually held by another company. And again, all that information's in these business articles. But there was a big, huge comic book boom in the 90s, and it was kind of a bubble, and it was almost kind of a speculative bubble. And this was kind of the part that I grew up in comics, and maybe people will remember this. It got kind of pumped into this thing where it was all special covers and glow-in-the-dark and special editions, and you were supposed to buy all these things because they were going to be worth money later. And little kids, of course, we hadn't figured out that anything they say, hey, this is going to be worth a lot of money later, is not going to be worth a lot of money later. It's the things you don't know about that are going to be worth money later. It's kind of an early important lesson, but I think I also, at the same time that I felt like I was getting scammed out of my money, I think I also realized I didn't like the stories all that much, whether it was, you know, Marvel superhero stuff or even some of the DC stuff. And at the time, I think that's when I started to read some of the, you know, mature readers comics. And that's when I got into, you know, Sandman and Hellblazer and those kind of comics for the remaining several years that I would continue to read them before I would just be full on music all the way once the late 90s kind of rolled around. And even once I got to college, you don't have money to buy comic books. But I knew that through those years and after that bubble burst, and a lot of this was just because of lots of other bubbles burst as well, whether it was happening in music or film or anything, Marvel was blown out. They got kind of tossed around a little bit, but ultimately Disney swoops in and buys Marvel for $4 billion. That must mean something, because that's a hell of a lot of money for what some people would go, oh, the funny books. But I think the interesting thing that's happened, and I noticed it just as I would glance at advertisements or see what people were going to the movies to see or look at the movie marquee, over the last couple of years, I was like, man, Marvel sure is putting out a bunch of movies. And it's basically that Disney, you know, just financially speaking, bought up these properties and have turned them into super big cash cows. And they're putting new superhero movies in theaters almost every month. And so almost like comic books themselves, they're coming out pretty steadily and they're making bajillions of dollars. So when I know that those are super duper popular and then I watch this Daredevil TV show, it strikes me, oh, this is how violent a lot of these things are. And I'm sure they tweak them just to kind of get the PG-13 rating, but that's a whole other BS area anyway with sex versus violence. But that's what struck me when seeing this TV show. It let me kind of get the glimpse of what was going on in all these movies that millions of people have been flocking to for years. And I think it comes down to this. These Marvel movies are a kind of post-9/11 war hawk wet dream. It's all, you know, kind of governments are inferior. You got to give up your, you know, your individual sovereignty so we can work, you know, collectivistly with, you know, military so we can go and beat, the, you know, those quote unquote aliens, whatever those aliens might be.
Right.
So yeah. That's really, I think, kind of struck me as I was just trying to watch a couple of TV shows.
You know, that's such an important point. It's the Tony Stark working in collaboration with the Department of Defense is going to save the universe. And isn't it so cool? And I think you're exactly right to point that out and to point out the propagandistic value of comic books, which is certainly not a new idea. I think I hope people do know the history of propaganda comics and how they were explicitly used for such purposes, perhaps most obviously in World War II, where, of course, Captain America went to fight Hitler and all of that kind of stuff, where it was just explicitly these comic book characters were being teamed up and used to basically sell war and to rally support in the homeland and condition the children and all of that kind of stuff. But I think, obviously, that never really went away. And there's an interesting... Actually, even Wikipedia has an interesting breakdown of some of the more blatant connections between, for example, not only the World War II propaganda or the Korean propaganda, but there's things like Grenada, the Rescued from Rape and Slavery, which was a 14-page comic published in 1984 by the Central Intelligence Agency, but it was, of course, not advertised as being a CIA publication. It was credited to something called the Victims of International Communist Emissaries, but it was a CIA publication and things like that.
Vice is that? Victims of International...
Yes, it is. Yeah. Voice.
Oh, Voice.
Victims of Internet. Yeah. I mean, apparently they don't know the conventions of acronyms. But anyway, yes. So, I mean, again, the connections there shouldn't be surprising. But here's an interesting story that caught my attention last year, which kind of puts this out on the table. And it quite explicitly ties in with what you're saying, and I think quite rightly, about the sort of this new resurgence of Marvel and DC characters in the movies and how it's selling this kind of post-9/11 violence porn. Well, the Moscow Times had a report last year, Russia investigating Marvel comic books as propaganda of violence. And it says, a Russian state company that distributes printed publications has asked the Federal Media Watchdog in Russia to investigate Marvel comic books for denigrating Soviet symbols and amounting to propaganda of a cult of violence. And it's basically talking about how comic books promote violence and cruelty and all of this. And of course, you got a lot of news outlets in the West covering this at the time, saying, oh, look at those hypocritical Russians, as if they are such peace-loving people and all of that, and, you know, look at what's going on in Ukraine and all of that spin. But I think the underlying point is well taken, that yes, these comic books really are propaganda of violence. They really do glorify it. And I think it can be done sort of responsibly in a way that makes people think about the moral lessons and the moral gravity of what's being done, and and vigilantism and does that really work and all of that kind of thing. And I think we probably, for people like myself and yourself who got out of the comic book propaganda matrix decades ago, that's probably more of the type of storyline that we remember. But I think what you're saying is interesting, that now that this entirely new, Marvel movie industry is forming, it really is introducing a whole new generation to these ideas, but really in a particular post-9/11 context. And I of course, a lot of people have talked about that in regards to the Batman reboot franchise and the sort of post-9/11 world that it was portraying. But I think it's interesting to look at how all of these comic books are doing this. And I guess I don't know what the sort of what the answer to this is per se, because unfortunately, comic books and things of comic nature are just inherently appealing to a lot of young people. Of course, young boys love to read these types of things and get stewed and soaked in these ideas and memes that are being put out there. And it's done in such a glossy and slick way. I mean, it is for mindless popcorn entertainment. I mean, it is eye candy and it is interesting to watch. It's very well shot, this Daredevil series. So it's extremely well done propaganda. And I guess there's a question of, is there anything that can be done to raise awareness of these issues in a way that hopefully brings up deflector shields for young people who are getting caught in this? I mean, I'm sure there are people listening to this conversation who have children or nephews or what have you who are at that age, that tender ripe age, that they're likely to be sucked up into this. What can we sort of do to counteract the propaganda of violence that these comic books are representing?
I think making I think in a lot of ways it's sort of making shows and being involved in it like this, where, yeah, we'll watch this, but let's do it in a thoughtful way. And just as you can kind of say, hey, you know, I'll give you the homework, you know, for next episode. I think if we can kind of do, and that's really the idea, you know, that, and that's why I think that's why I love doing film, literature, New World Order, because it's like the group within the Tragedy and Hope community navigating Netflix. It's that idea of, you know, we can watch these things, but let's do it in a thoughtful way. And I think it's much like we probably would have wished, you know, parents, you know, instead of taking records from us, would have maybe sat down and listened to it with us and said, here's why I don't like this, or those kinds of things, instead of just, that looks dirty and I'm going to take that away. And that happened to me as a kid growing up. So that informs probably a lot of my own way. But I think it, going at it thoughtfully, and I think having ways that show these are being used as propaganda, because we can prove that our tax dollars and so many other dollars go from the military to expressly make these kinds of shows and video games and all those things. I'll throw in a link from Spy Culture, U.S. Army influence on Hollywood. They've actually got documents from 2010 to 2015 about all the ways the U.S. Army has all these projects they're working on. And Hollywood sounds like a big hoity-toity thing, but you boil it down and it's still stupid-ass reality shows and every kind of little bit of media that the military entertainment industrial complex has kind of gotten involved in. So I think when you can help expose it, that helps kind of stem the tide, I think, in a lot of ways. And hopefully, just like people make the right decisions once they learn their food was poison, that when they're rolling into a movie theater, they're going to go, yeah, maybe let's do something else or let's see something else.
And might I just interject, I think perhaps keeping all of that in mind, perhaps it's also fruitful, beneficial, not to try to talk down to people who are interested or involved in this kind of propaganda matrix, because, again, I think that's a way of putting people off of this. I think more exploratory, opening up for discussion, talking about the demonstrable propaganda links between the comic book companies and the Hollywood complex and the Pentagon and the CIA and these types of things, these historical linkages, opening them up as questions and points for exploration rather than a lecture is probably going to be more effective when you're trying to expose some of this to people.
Because I'm pretty sure in some of these films, you know, Thor and Captain America and all these, I think they have elements within the storylines that were this 10 years earlier, James, we would be singing its praises because, oh man, they're talking about false flag terrorism or they're exposing the U.S. government's connection to Nazis. These elements I think are in there, but now that we're so kind of, you know, we are so now 15 years post 9/11, that it's not a novelty and they're not sneaking it in there like people were maybe getting away with it a decade plus ago and trutherism basically slipping into mainstream media. I think that's kind of over and done with and it's now been absorbed. And that's why, you know, Kanye and TV shows can joke about the Illuminati because it's all sort of out there and it's all just a big gigantic mess.
Yes, but on that note, well, before we get to that, I should just point out that, again, for people who don't know, there is a direct link between the Pentagon and Marvel Studios, the company that puts out the big blockbuster movies, and that link was supposedly broken, I believe, earlier this year. Basically, the Pentagon has supposedly broken its link with Marvel Studios because of the unreality of the Avengers-type movies, but I haven't seen it yet. Apparently, what is it, Captain America Winter Soldier, or whatever the most recent Captain America one was apparently an interesting expose, more so than propaganda, so perhaps there is some genuine exposure of some sort of truth going on through these movies that rankled the Pentagon in the wrong way. Maybe that's all just a diversion, but anyway, on the note of trutherism in these types of productions, when I was watching this series, the first episode contains that storyline about the contractor that received all of these contracts in the wake of 9/11 for the 9/11 cleanup and reconstruction. And I was assuming A, that was going to be sort of more of an overarching sort of plot line. I'm only up to episode 3, but it hasn't returned at this point. But I thought this was probably why, this is why James wants to talk about this. But I thought that was, at any rate, it's an interesting thing to throw in there. And maybe it's just like one of those things like in the, there was that James Bond movie where they were talking about 9/11 in a sort of false flaggy way. I can't even remember the details of it because I don't really watch the Bond movies, but there's a lot of those kind of references that are thrown in years later that just kind of normalize it. Like, oh yeah, okay, it was a big boondoggle. A lot of people made a lot of money off of 9/11, and there you go. And just sort of throwing it out there. I don't know if that's bringing it to people's attention in a way that will make them think about it, or bringing it out in a way that will make just sort of normalize people to the idea. But I thought that was an interesting little plot line to have in there.
Absolutely. And I think that was what I was referring to, the Winter Soldier. I think I picked up on some of that. I was probably still producing at Ground Zero when that film came out. So I think that was probably something we discussed on there. I heard just a little bit about it. But, you know, I think there's a lot of other areas worthy of exploration. And I think these kind of topics are fun because different people are going to pick up on different areas. And there are people going, why haven't you talked about Disney that bought Marvel? Disney's whole mission is to sort of subvert your childhood. And that's a valid other area of pursuit. I think what strikes me again about this, and you did mention DC, that was always the thing growing up. I mean, did you kind of catch this as well? DC was the darker branch of comics, and Marvel had a little bit more of, you know, Spider-Man was much more of an everyman, not like some, you know,
dark, tortured, vigilante kind of guy, yeah.
Lives in a cave, or some space alien Superman. Right. From a planet. But it seems like Disney has made Marvel out-dark DC.
Yeah. Well, the words gritty reboot are used a little too much for my taste in this era, but certainly that is the formula for Hollywood success, seemingly, if box office numbers are anything to go by. And I guess it's just a question of who can go for the grittier reboot. Is it Batman, or is it Daredevil, or what have you? And I think they just are playing a game of one-upsmanship, and unfortunately, the public seems to be continuing to buy it, both literally and figuratively.
They do. And the movies sell tickets, they break even, they make money. And of course, they make even more money when they go worldwide. So they probably aren't going to go away anytime soon. But I just, every week as I look, it's like these are commercials for a sort of militarized collectivist future, you know, now playing.
Yes. Yes, it absolutely is. Well, Well, now, given that I've only made it up to episode 3, or the end of episode 3 of the series, is it worth me continuing on, do you think?
Well, I haven't actually gone all the way. I think I'm up to probably episode 9 or so myself, episode 9 called Speak of the Devil. And it is, you know, it's interesting. I don't know that I would say, yes, you've got to watch all of it. Now, maybe if I watch all 13 episodes, we can come back and say, yes, it all comes together. And here are the parts we could have mentioned had we gone through the whole thing. But I think something like this, in some ways, again, we're not exactly talking about fine art or literature. In some ways, this is kind of a comic you and I are picking up and flipping open and hopefully discussing and pointing out some of the interesting areas and pointing out who's behind what. Because when I look at, you know, the guy who directed or created this sort of gritty reboot for Netflix, I don't see any of the typical, like, oh, this guy's got a creepy background and he's from this military family or Yale. He's the guy who made Cloverfield. That was his first big feature that he wrote that kind of made him big. And then he also made Cabin in the Woods. Both films are actually, you know, pretty critically acclaimed. Cabin in the Woods, I think, is actually worthy of discussion and has been discussed on other sort of esoteric media sites, probably Vigilant Citizen and lots of other sites. So I think in some ways this is a little bit of like a trashier popcorn thing that has darker implications, James. And I think the links that we can throw in, and, you know, you read the New York Times about, you know, Disney spending $4 billion, you know, they're not doing it for nothing.
No, they certainly aren't. And it's not just monetary greed, I think, at play. As you say, Disney is there to subvert our childhoods. And I think that is something that I'll have to cover more explicitly in a future edition of FLNWO. But for now, I'd like to thank you for sort of popping my bubble of ignorance when it comes to these Marvel productions, because they are such a pop cultural phenomenon that we have to deal with them in some way. And I'm sure there will be people in the crowd who are much more well-versed on these and probably bigger fans of the comic books in question, who can probably fill us in on some of them, the more specific details. But I'm glad, again, that you popped the bubble of ignorance on this subject, because it was something that really struck me when I was back in Canada recently. I was staying at a hotel once where there was some CNN and BBC and that kind of thing, and it really reminded me of just how propagandistic it is, because I really don't watch those things. I see little clips online, but I don't watch news networks like that, and it is good to be reminded just how incredibly it's just like this propaganda tsunami that just is striking you every day. And for people who live in that, I just shudder to think of the way they're being conditioned. So for people who are living through this age of Marvel Comics domination of the entertainment sphere, I'm sure that there is a whole range of things to be discussed. Anyway, I think that's just about it from my side. Is there anything else that you want to cover with regards to this?
I would just say that's what's nice about on demand and the ability to make an informed decision and decide, I'm going to sit down and watch this because I've already armed myself with the knowledge of what this is about and what I'm going to watch. You can watch it with a little more forethought. And that's the difference between then just getting the 24/7 advertisement barrage. And that's the thing, because they both work together. You get the media and then you get the advertisements, and they both kind of dovetail together. I don't know. My brain is always, I'm always still surprised when I hear a car go down the road and I hear commercials coming out of it. It's day and age. The millions of choices. You can be listening to any number of crappy music if you want, but listening to ads, that's a whole area too. But I think having Netflix and having on-demand things makes it a little easier to make these in kind of informed decisions, and you can kind of stop and turn away and not watch the rest of it, and it's not this bilge kind of constantly coming into your house. My last note that I had, and you hit it exactly, is that I said, maybe the comments will have more in-depth analysis.
Yeah.
The reality is, hopefully there will be people out there who did read the Daredevil comic and who can take this hopefully further and point out areas that we haven't missed.
Right, yes. Well, that's the beauty of the collaborative learning. And let me just point out the other option when it comes to the beauty of these on-demand services and things is that you can choose not to start watching it at all if you don't want to. That's always an option. So there you go. All right, well, we've covered the bases there. And before I let you go, I think there are some interesting developments coming along in terms of the media monarchy world. Is there anything you'd like to let the listeners know about, or will we start
well,
to...
I think I almost even kind of said when I mentioned navigating Netflix, watch out, I might make a whole hell of a lot more media, because I actually resigned from my commercial radio job. It just started
Yay.
To be too much of my life, and I think this hits exactly kind of what we're talking about. I was listening to commercials all the time. I mean, I have, pretty good ability. I can, because I was running the board, I can literally turn them down in my headphones as I did. But still, it's that it just kind of infected my life in a lot of ways. But I made a lot of great connections and got a lot of great ideas. And I realized the only thing that's really going to make me happy is giving Media Monarchy a full on go. And so I'm basically kind of, I don't know if circling the wagons is the right way, but I'm with my web guy. I'm trying to corral a couple of other people to basically do a complete kind of overhaul of the Media Monarchy kingdom, solidify everything back down to MediaMonarchy.com, and do a lot more media, a lot more videos, a lot more media criticism. So whether that is, film and television, and a lot more music. And I think that's the push that I'm going to kind of go for as Media Monarchy's 10th anniversary is actually September 11th, 2015.
That's awesome. I'm very much looking forward to it. And if nothing else, if you only brought back the weekly podcast, that would be a godsend for me, because it was such a valuable resource for me week after week with all of those great stories. So I'm looking forward to whatever comes of this new iteration, this gritty reboot of Media Monarchy. But we'll leave it there for now. James, thank you again for your time. Thanks for bringing this to the table.
Thanks, man. It's a pleasure.
All right, friends, that's going to do it for, I was going to say this month's edition of Film Literature in the New World Order, but actually there's going to be another edition very soon, actually. Before you know it, there will be a new edition of this podcast out. So I will give you your homework reading assignment for next time, and you'll have to read quickly in order to make it for next podcast. But as always, let's just go through some of the comments that were left on the previous edition of this podcast, number 27, The Library of Babel by Jorge Luis Borges, and there were quite a few interesting comments. I started the conversation off by linking to a piece by James Grummelman about information policy for the Library of Babel, adding some interesting points to that whole concept, and Octium responded by saying, that if we take the more search engines, the better to its logical extreme, we'd have everyone setting up their own search engine, which share results with everyone else. And the obvious problem with that idea is that the average person does not have the same resources as a corporation like Google. However, there is at least one open source solution called Yacy, that implements a peer-to-peer distributed search engine of which your computer becomes part of once you install the application. I would not say that it passes the competency test as Bookman yet. However, the concept looks promising, and it should improve if more people participate. Well, that's an interesting little idea. I hadn't heard of that before, so thanks for bringing it to our attention. And if anyone is participating in that peer-to-peer search engine and has any feedback on it, I'd be interested to hear it. We had a comment in, for example, from JM talking about some rather esoteric parts, the animal communicator and cell talk and light possible scientist experiences ebook and many other links in there besides that you can read through. We had F. Garcia Gonzalo bringing to our attention an interesting clip from an interview on Spanish television in 1976 where Borges stated, "I am certainly not a nationalist, a Peronist, or a communist. Let's just say I am an individual, a modest anarchist in the Spencer tradition. I believe in the individual, not the state." And apparently this was published on Mises Hispano. So that's excellent. I had no idea that was the case. I had no idea about Borges's political inclinations. Interesting to hear about. I guess I'll have to research more into that. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. Again, lots of different comments in from a lot of different people. For example, William York talking about how he appreciates Borges, and anyone else who does so is recommended to check out Stanislaw Lem's book, A Perfect Vacuum, which I have not done so yet myself, but I am looking forward to. Thank you for the recommendation. The always interesting Steve Kelly 911 has a very, 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 very long comment in which he starts by saying, this story actually gets to the heart of deliberate technocratic social engineering and how the Library of Babel can become a customized and tailored prison for each individual mind, kind of like a you-are-what-you-eat scenario where your favorite food is deliberately fed to you and an algorithm works out the most effective route possible to get you psychologically from point A to point Z by introducing 5% new and different forbidden fruit that it attempts to tempt you with through profiling. Point Z is point zombie, where you are disengaged from politics and immersed into pure materialism or cultish behavior, such as the climate action protesters who laugh at you when you ask them what a carbon derivative is. And again, this comment is very, very long, so I'll let you read through, but some interesting ideas and parallels and thoughts brought out in that comment. And also Philip had an interesting point where he pointed out that the six-sided room is the benzene ring, which is symbolic of Earth's carbon-based life forms. And then the books, with their systematically inscribed but generally incomprehensible text, is our DNA, and the DNA of all other living things. And some books, like Cells of Our Body, may be destroyed, but the DNA itself lives on in other books and cells. An interesting idea. Thank you for bringing that idea to the table. There's a lot of ideas in that story, as I'm sure you all recognized. So, well, given the type of literary whiplash that we're prone to here on the podcast, we were reading Borges last month, we were watching the Daredevil television series for this month, and, well, what's coming up next? Well, on the third Monday of August, we're going to be reviewing A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. So, yes, once again, literary whiplash here on the podcast, but one of my favorite writers, so it will be a very interesting discussion, I have no doubt. I hope you'll be there to join me for it. Once again, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. I'm looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
The Corbett Report is brought to you by The Corbett Report Subscriber, a weekly newsletter featuring James Corbett's International Forecaster editorial, recommended reading and viewing, discounts on Corbett Report DVDs, and once a month, a subscriber-only video. Sign up today to start receiving your copy at CorbettReport.com/support.